We're going to cover about six different areas today, and I will be covering the first three sections, and Jim Harford will be covering the final three. We will shoot for being done with this, the first three sections, about 3 o'clock. We will be taking a break at 2:30. That'll be a 15-minute break, and if I go over, we'll try to work that break in. But Jim's the time police, and I think he's going to keep us honest here. Our main focus in this presentation will, in fact, be practical issues, commonly encountered issues, and not well understood issues, which for a lot of the LDRs, I think, is pretty much the whole thing. As we look at the big picture, the basic framework for hazardous waste regulations was provided in the 1976 Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. It, of course, contains the framework for hazardous waste management, and it's designed to protect human health and the environment from the dangers associated with generation, transportation, storage, and disposal of hazardous waste. By the mid-1980s, Congress was concerned that the existing practices in RCRA were not protective and that new authorities were created, and as a result of that, they created new authorities in what would become known as the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments of 1984. One of the new authorities is found in 3004M, and that is the requirement to minimize short and long-term threats to human health and the environment by reducing the toxicity and the mobility of hazardous constituents found in the waste. This became the basis for the Land Disposal Restrictions Program. EPA developed the Land Disposal Restriction Regulations in about 9 stages, in fact, exactly 9 stages, in what would be a collection of over 100 federal registers. So if you're sitting there wondering, where do I find this information? It's scattered. It's out there. Now, what's really cool is we have provided you a web resource link that is on the last page of this presentation. The web resource slide at the end of this presentation will, in fact, link you to an online resource for all of those federal registers. So, nice little piece of research, or a nice resource to have on hand. Let's take a look at the LDR program. The extensive requirements within the LDR program took about 15 years to put in place and are based on the prohibition that hazardous waste being disposed must meet treatment standards. I call this LDR's simplified goal. We get caught up in the notifications, we get caught up in the treatment standards, we get caught up in the alternative standards, and we lose sight of the goal. There was one goal. It was found in 3004M. We're going to reduce toxicity and mobility of these constituents. How do we do that? We treat the waste. If you haven't met the treatment standard, you don't dispose of the waste. It's that easy. We made that little concept pretty complicated. Now, what we're going to talk about today will be, what are those treatment standards? What is disposal? And what? How do we interpret these treatment standards? Because they seem to come in a lot of different flavors. Okay? So, go to the next slide. Okay. The treatment standards are intended to assure this reduction of mobility and toxicity. And as a result of doing that, they provide a second level of protection over the technology-based protective barriers that were also part of the Hazardous Solid Waste Amendments. So it's the belt and suspenders approach that we took as a result of the regulations that came out at that time to implement the requirements found in HISWA. Today at EPA, we are not working on new LDR rules. Is there an amen to that? It has to be. The LDR program is instead working on variances and equivalent treatment issues. Today, we will not be talking about those particular regulations. And as a result of that, I would also want to remind you that everything that I say here today, again, state programs can be more restrictive. So consider this as a base that you can implement on or improve on. Additionally, if you would, as you look at these LDR rules, keep in mind that there is some room for interpretation. As you look at the site-specific conditions associated with it, but it's narrow, but there is some room for interpretation. This is going to the basics. There are three prohibitions that are in the LDRs, which we use to achieve our simplified goal. The prohibition against disposal, which requires adequate treatment to meet treatment standards. The prohibition against dilution, which ensures proper treatment, and the prohibition against storage, which prevents indefinite storage as an attempt to avoid treatment standards or disposal. I was recently asked to come in and work with an Asian country which was just implementing their hazardous waste laws. They didn't have any. They were just in the process of implementing it. They permitted the incinerator, which was to be their treatment facility for their country. And I said, where's the waste coming from? They said, it's been in storage for 20 years all over the country. So literally, their approach to hazardous waste management had been storing waste. Well, in LDRs, we recognize that that's something people may want to do to avoid regulation, and that's also prohibited. And we'll talk about that prohibition. In fact, we'll talk about all these prohibitions in more detail. The key thing that we're trying to do is to take waste, which is destined for disposal, and prevent that waste from being disposed without meeting treatment standards. Okay? Base concept. That's it. So, to be subject to LDRs, the waste must be destined for disposal. Make sense? All right. So land disposal, of course, is defined in a very broad sense. So placement in or on the land. You could stop right there with that definition. Because that pretty much says it all. And then we give examples of the landfill, surface settlement, waste pile, injection well, land treatment facility, salt dome, bed formation. Does anybody have any caves where people want to store or dispose of hazardous waste? They're so great for other stuff. Okay. Concrete vaults, bunkers in the ground, of course. So this definition is intended to be comprehensive, and it is comprehensive, and it does basically cover all the bases. But missing from this slide is an exemption, which is found in that definition of disposal, and that's for corrective action. And later on, we're going to talk about corrective action. But in particular, what's missing is that you can have corrective action management units and staging piles at a corrective action site where LDRs do not apply. Sounds contrary to what we're talking about here. But to encourage corrective action, we have corrective action management units, and we'll talk about those later on in the presentation. These terms that are in this slide, restricted and prohibited waste, are terms which are no longer in use today. They're in the regs, but they've lost their significance because now when new wastes are promulgated, they're immediately prohibited from being land disposed. So the concept, again, that I just used there, prohibited from land disposal, meaning what? That you can't land dispose of it? No. What's the goal? To treat before land disposal. So all new wastes which are promulgated will automatically come out now with their own treatment standard. And as a result, they're prohibited unless that treatment standard is met. They're prohibited from being land disposed. Okay? Next slide. So we keep talking about treatment. Treatment comes in two flavors. Technology-based and concentration-based. What the agency recognized early on was that wastes were very different and that you couldn't just require a concentration-based standard and say, treat to this level and you can dispose of it. Wastes were different. As a result, the technical treatment standards are based on technical practicability, not on risk. And we'll look at how that affects how we interpret that particular treatment standard. In specific, though, waste with a technology-based standard must use the technology specified. What we find in 268.40 are the treatment standards for all hazardous waste. And in table 268.40, there will be technologies that are specified for particular waste. And there will then also be concentrations. There will be also on that table the standards for listed waste and for characteristic waste. And as we'll see here in a little bit, they're different how we interpret them. This morning there was the reference to underlying hazardous constituents, how we had to keep our eye on underlying hazardous constituents, that people were losing the significance of that with regard to waste which were being disposed. And we'll hopefully, after today, you'll understand exactly what that response is. All right. Let's test our knowledge with regard to treatment standards. What treatment technologies are approved to meet concentration standards? Anybody?
Hello?
Any treatment that is not impermissible dilution. You know, it's like everything in RCRA. It's like just when you think you know the answer, there's a twist. That facility that was referenced today, the DuPont facility that was referenced today, does a tremendous amount of wastewater treatment. Right? And that type of facility has provisions which are addressed through the LDRs. And we'll take a look at that concept because that's captured in this concept of impermissible dilution. As we look at the technologies which the agency has identified, there are some treatment standards that will require a specific technology, as I mentioned earlier, but then where you have these concentration-based standards, any technology which gets you there is acceptable. Okay. Key points. We'll go on to the next one. All right. 268.40, sometimes known as the LDR treatment standards table. If you go to 268.40, it contains the standards for all hazardous waste. But you would find over on the right-hand side of that table, there's a wastewater and a water subcategory. Water and wastewater have different physical and chemical properties, and therefore different technologies will affect them differently. What is not on that table, and comes in the second half of this presentation, are the treatment standards for soil, debris, and lab packs. So what is in that table? All the hazardous waste codes and their water and wastewater treatment standards. For things like soil, debris, and lab packs, we'll cover those. We'll see that they come in a different part of the regulations. The concept of wastewater is really important. Again, because as we look at our hazardous waste, they're either going to be wastewater or non-wastewater. So if we define wastewater, anything that's not wastewater is non-wastewater. Make sense? We're not going to define both. We're just going to define one. So what is wastewater? Wastewater are wastes that are less than 1% by weight of total organic carbon. What's that mean?
Because it's liquid, and it's a real low concentration of carbon present. Not to be confused with, say, a solvent that's liquid, would have a high TOC, or an alcohol, or any other concentrated organic compound. It'll be liquid, but it won't be wastewater, right, because of this provision. Then there's a second provision. There's an and in this definition. And less than 1% by weight of total suspended solids. So by its nature, it will be aqueous, and the percent of solids will be very low, less than 1%. If you don't meet both of those criteria, you're not a wastewater. You would have to satisfy the standard, treatment standard, in that table for non-wastewater. Okay? Next slide. Something that's often overlooked in implementing regulations is looking at the applicability section, and LDRs is no exception. 268.1 basically defines to whom LDR regulations apply. There's few people, or there's a few waste streams as well, that are not regulated by the applicability section in 268.1. These are the ones shown on this slide. There is some, or there are some exemptions which provide for allowance for waste to go to Clean Water Act treatment and pretreatment systems, and we'll be covering those in a couple of slides later on. On this slide, we see the soil debris and lab pack waste. Why do we differentiate these particular wastes from all the other wastes and say they need their own treatment standards? Any ideas? It's not a water wastewater. Well, the soils would be non-wastewater, right? No process knowledge. What, remediation? Okay. 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 A business loophole? Well, we have CAMUs that come up later on, and we're going to deal with remediation waste in CAMUs, right? And, you know, I think a lot of waste wants to go that way, but certainly by providing a soil and debris standard, it allows for more waste to be treated. Yes, sir? The matrices are different.
Is it possible for you to speak up a little?
Are you asking that the questions be louder or that the speaker be louder?
The speaker be louder.
Can we handle that in the back of the room? Okay, how is this? Is this loud enough for you?
Better.
Is that better?
Yes.
Thank you. The alternative treatment standard, I don't know, this is pretty loud here now. for soil, debris, and lab packs, we will cover those later on. As I mentioned earlier, the land disposal restrictions provide for variances. That you're looking at is different than the waste which the agency contemplated would be covered, and you can specifically ask for variances to meet the site-specific nature of this unique waste. Those are the types of things that the agency is especially working on. Also on the slide is the equivalent treatment determination. And in this case, if you have a technology which is different than the specified technology for waste, but provides equivalent treatment, you can also petition to use that type of technology. So, right now, those are the two areas where EPA headquarters is working on as they try to provide guidance for implementing of the LDRs. A slide that comes up later on will also deal with remediation waste and policies, and we'll see how some of the ideas that came out with regard to the soil question will, in fact, be addressed through there.
I'm sorry, but we still can't hear you at this end.
If we go any louder in this room, we're going to blast the people here. Is there a can we get, provide gain on the Internet, but not? Are you on the Internet or are you on the phone?
Just on the phone line. We've tried making phone calls, too, but haven't gotten any relief.
And how loud are we at this point?
It sounds like a whisper. We're kind of huddled around the speakerphone.
Whoa. In this room, it's very loud. I wish you were here.
Yeah. Us too. We'll just let you continue then. I guess we've done what we can do. So, thank you.
Sorry. Okay. We are now at the, what do the LDRs, let's go to the next slide. When do LDRs attach to waste? From this point forward, we're going to start speaking specifically about issues, misunderstandings, or issues which need to be understood to be able to make LDR compliance determinations. The very first fundamental issue we need to address is when do LDRs attach? Now, that seems like a simple concept. Is it with the moment my waste is created? Is it the moment that my waste is destined to be disposed? Is it when I've treated it and then I want to dispose of it? Is it after I've commingled it throughout my facility and then I want to dispose of it? When do LDRs attach to my hazardous waste? Anybody?
At the point.
At the point? Of generation. Of generation. Yes. At the point in time of generation, okay? As a waste, yes?
At the point it leaves the generating unit.
At the point it leaves the generating unit. These are all good answers, because they're all, again, remember when I said there is some room for interpretation? The official answer is at the point of generation. So, if, you know, when that waste is generated, LDR is attached. What's that mean? Well, let's realize, at that point you have a prohibited waste, right? Yes, sir?
I was just going to say, it can't be an LDR waste unless it's a hazardous waste,
so you have to have a certain time that something has this waste, and then it co-generates as a hazardous waste. So you're saying you would want to make a hazardous waste determination? No. You'll need to speak up a little bit. Can we get a mic back to him? We have the hand pillar, so this needs to be picked up, okay?
I wouldn't say per se that you have to make the determination first, because generators are required to understand the nature of their waste. So in an ongoing process, that has really been done. So there's an ethical valve somewhere in the process. The waste comes through that. It's a hazardous waste. LDRs attach at that point in time.
In fact, that is true. And then also the point with regard to when it leaves the unit. Some wastes are generated in a unit, but they don't become regulated until they leave the unit. Correct? All right. So here's the key point. LDRs are going to attach at that point of generation whenever you determine where, when and wherever that point is, right? Yeah. Key point. It doesn't attach later. It doesn't attach as it's going to disposal. It doesn't attach during treatment. Okay? It's at that point of generation. Yes, sir?
When you say at the point of generation, is it, in my mind, what I see is if you're doing a remediation and then you, let's say, soil is contaminated, you do your cleanup and you put it into the drum. I'm just trying to visualize this. So is it at the end of the day when you start storing your waste? Is that what you mean by point of generation?
Can you ask that question when we get to the remediation slide? Can I ask you to hold it till then?
Because sure. We're going to have an extensive slide on that.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
We came across a situation with a foundry, and they had air pollution control dust, and they were treating in the air duct, so when it came out into the baghouse, it was no longer hazardous. But at the point it was generated coming out of the furnace, it was hazardous and was basically being diluted through them injecting into the air pollution control ducts. So we said it was the point of generation is when it came out of the furnace.
Which was the unit of generation.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, that would make sense. Okay. So it seems like a simple concept, but in fact there's a lot of interpretation here. Jim, this example that's up here, is one that you're familiar with. Would you be able to just address that for us and give us some insight on this?
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting one because that was a result of an assistance visit we did at the site. The facility was engaged in doing a lot of painting of irrigation equipment, and what they had was the not-so-uncommon experience of paint booth filters that spontaneously combusted. And they couldn't very well deny it because people were saying that, yeah, they saw it happen just as they were sitting in piles. So what this outfit did was is that they said, okay, fine, we don't want this. So they put the paint booth filters inside drums full of water. Well, at that point, then, of course, what you've got is you've got the water that becomes part of the hazardous waste stream. And what they were doing was saying, well, it's not hazardous because the water itself didn't meet the definition of hazardous waste, but then sending the water directly to an impoundment, just taking the drum and pouring it in an impoundment, which, of course, is considered land disposal. What we found out, though, is that because it was hazardous at the point of generation, LDR rules attached, and they had to identify underlying hazardous constituents. So what we had them do was review the MSDSs they used for the paints, and had them test to see what was coming across the paint booth filters. And sure enough, it came back with underlying hazardous constituents, which means they were illegally disposing of prohibited waste in their impoundments. But those are the kind of things you can see sometimes. Now we haven't really discussed UHCs yet, but Felix will get into that just here shortly.
Thank you, Jim. We'll go to the next slide, please. Section 68.7 requires generators to make a LDR waste determination. This particular requirement is very analogous to a generator making a solid waste, hazardous waste determination. There are requirements that allow the generator of the restricted, prohibited waste, allow him to do an analysis, or to have knowledge of the waste. And I would ask you to, if you've got handouts on this particular slide, not knowledge of the process, but knowledge of the waste, that the generator can use that basis for making that determination. It's a rebuttable presumption. If he uses knowledge of the waste, he would have to document that and be correct with that determination. Yes, sir. The question is, can you use a statistical approach to build a knowledge base over time? In essence, he's taking enough grab samples to show that there is some degree of reliability, and then the question becomes, what is that, 99%, 95%? Yeah, and I think that's where state determination is going to be key to making that enforcement call.
One of the things that we would add is that, yes, you can do that, but only on that individual, on that particular waste. You can't use somebody else's statistical results like you see sometimes in solvent corporations. They use waste codes that are, that apply across the board from everybody's waste. This applies to the generator's waste only.
Okay. Also on the slide, I think another take-home point is that the treatment standards are based on TCLP analyses for metals. There are a few, very few, that are total, not TCLP, so you need to be aware of that. When it comes to wastewater, it's total. It'll be milligrams per liter, okay? But on the solids, it'll be pretty much TCLP analysis. For organics, it's always total. It won't be a TCLP on the organics. Okay, if we could go to the next one, please. The LDRs apply to characteristic and listed waste. No big secret. We've already seen that. How do they apply to these waste streams? The same or differently? That's a question that we have to address because, in fact, they apply differently. The approach was different, and the end results after treatment are very different. As you know, characteristic wastes are regulated until they are no longer characteristic, and they're not, at that point, not hazardous waste. Listed wastes are treated, and they still are listed wastes until delisted. So a very key difference in what happens to the characteristic waste that goes through LDRs versus a listed waste, which goes through LDRs. The issue to keep in mind in understanding the treatment standards for listed and characteristic waste is that the listed waste must be treated to address their associated hazardous constituents. Those associated hazardous constituents are defined in 26840 for listed waste. Key point. Very key point. For characteristic waste, they have underlying hazardous constituents, and any constituent which is present, which is found in 26848, in the universal treatment standards, is considered an underlying hazardous constituent. There are exemptions in the definition of underlying hazardous constituents for compounds like fluoride, selenium, and we'll get into some of those later on. But the key point, 26840 specifies the associated hazardous constituents for listed waste. It says characteristic waste, you have to decharacterize the waste, and you have to meet the universal treatment standards for any underlying hazardous constituents which are present or expected to be present or which would be likely to be present in that waste. Now, if I'm generating a waste at my facility, not every chemical that is present in the universal treatment standards is going to be present. If my facility doesn't deal with pesticides, I wouldn't be expected to have pesticides as an underlying hazardous constituent in my waste stream. Okay? So it's a judgment call, it's a regulatory call, as to what those underlying hazardous constituents are. And the generator is the one that's expected to make that determination. Okay? But he should have a basis for doing that. So let's look at the concept of underlying hazardous constituents, which is on the next slide. So the generator must determine if the underlying hazardous constituents are present in a characteristic way. As I mentioned earlier, if he isn't reasonably expected to have a constituent, then he doesn't have to test for that constituent. The underlying hazardous constituents are about 250 chemicals, and they are found in table 26840, which is the universal treatment standards table. The underlying hazardous constituents are defined in 268.1, and they do have an exclusion
And we'll cover that exclusion here in a little bit. If we go to the next slide.
Just one comment on the...
I don't think you're on.
Just one comment on the UHC's presence, no change. Throughout this briefing, you're going to see comments like no change, or you're going to see some comments change. What that refers to is the changes that became... that were put into the federal regulations under the burden reduction rule that's just recently been put out. There's been, in this case, there's been no change in determination of UHC's present and characteristic waste as a result of the burden reduction initiative.
So we've mentioned the Universal Treatment Standards table 26848. This table came after the treatment standards. This particular table did something that simplified the treatment standards that we had initially put out by the agency. Historically, those treatment standards had been based on best demonstrated available technology. The unintended consequence of that was that numeric treatment standards were different. So I could have benzene in one particular waste, I had it appearing in another one, and another one, and another one. And depending on the waste stream, benzene had different concentrations that it had to be met for in that particular waste. So that was a problem. To simplify that, the Universal Treatment Standards table was created, and EPA established basically a single numeric value. The process was then simplified further, where we took that UTS value and then it was the value that was put into all of the listed waste as well. Next slide. Now, let's see how well we've done in capturing the concept of hazardous constituents and hazardous constituents.
What is the high QLC exception, please?
The high QLC exception in... for characteristic for ignitable waste? Is that what you're asking?
It's just one of your bullets on slide 18.
If you look at the 26840 table, there are different subcategories for D001, which is ignitable waste. If you have waste which has a very high TOC value, I forget what the concentration cutoff is, 10%, you will have technology requirements which are different than if you had a TOC value with a low concentration. And if you go to the citation there, and if you go to 26840, you'll see the that explained. Is that okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, slide 20. All right. So the question becomes now, how well do we understand it? Let's ask the question. How is a regulated hazardous constituent different from an underlying hazardous constituent? Don't put it up yet. And don't look at the next slide. Hazardous constituent, underlying hazardous constituent. What was the difference? Anybody? Listed in characteristic waste. That's right. So if you look at the table, 26840, you're going to see chemical, wastewater, and non-wastewater. You're going to see characteristics, and then you're going to see listed waste. So most of that table is listed waste, isn't it? And for the listed waste, there will be hazardous constituents that are identified for each listed waste that are identified in that table. For the characteristic waste, pretty much is going to say, except for G001, it's going to say decharacterize, and then go look back at that table 26848 and any underlying hazardous constituents that you've got in your waste, treat it down to those levels. Unless, and then the exception is the clean water provisions, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay, so let's see how good we did on the answer. Does that answer look correct? Or there's an error in the first paragraph. Can you find it? find the error in the first paragraph, based on the answer I just gave you. It'll be both. Yeah. 268.40 has the treatment standards for listed and TC waste. So the last line, the last sentence. So, known to be listed in TC waste and are found in 268.40 table for the listed and characteristic waste codes. Right. Again, nothing in RCRA, straightforward. Are you any answers? The UHCs are defined in 268.2. That's a section of definitions. Very useful definitions to keep in mind, because some of these definitions are things that you have to keep going back and referring to. And within 268.2 is the definition for UHCs, and there are chemicals which appear on the Universal Treatment Standards table which are not considered UHCs. And that would be for fluoride, selenium, sulfide, vanadium, and zinc, by definition. Okay? You should be aware of that. Okay. Next slide. Doesn't look like anybody was confused. That was great. But let's ask the same question now with a twist. Do listed wastes have to meet the UHC treatment standards? Yes.
If they also carry
a characteristic code in addition to being listed.
Right.
You're saying.
But which isn't addressed in that LDR.
Oh, very good. Did you go to the next page? You don't even have a handout. Well, yes. Let's go to the next slide. The listed waste, which also carries a characteristic, will have to be treated to address underlying hazardous constituents if the chemical which makes it characteristic is not addressed as a hazardous constituent in the listing, in the listed waste. So let's get, for example, benzene. We've talked about benzene. So I could have a petroleum waste, say KO48. No, that's a bad one. KO52. Something that has benzene as a listed hazardous constituent. And then if it is showing characteristic for benzene, then by addressing the benzene that's part of the listed, then I don't have to address the underlying hazardous constituents. But if there's a characteristic in that waste, let's pick a different chemical. Now, selenium is exempt from UHCs. Give me another one. TCE. Did I hear TCE? Oh, TCE. If I have KO52 and I've got TCE present, well, I don't think KO52 has TCE listed as a hazardous constituent. But TCE could make that waste characteristic, right? So I got KO52, I got TCE present, and then the TCE is a high enough level, it's characteristic. Now what do I have to do? Now I have to address all underlying hazardous constituents in addition to the hazardous constituents present in KO52. That's the twist that this slide is talking about. Okay, was that confusing enough? Also, contaminated soils with listed waste is subject to uniform hazardous constituent standards if the alternative soil standards are used. We're going to talk about the alternative soil standards in the second half of this presentation, and we'll see how soils are different. Okay? Just when you think you've got it, along comes another subcategory of waste. Okay, we'll go to the next one.
One of the prohibitions that we talked about earlier was the prohibition against disposal without treatment standards, and then the other one was the prohibition against dilution to avoid treatment. I guess the example was with regard to the air pollution control dust before it went to the bag house. They diluted it, so that would have been an example of using a solid to dilute a solid to lower the concentration. It's probably a characteristic list. Right. So what is the dilution prohibition? Basically, where you add soil or water to lower concentrations in order to meet the concentration-based standards. Right? You could add soil to a solid, or you could add water to a liquid. Those concentrations came down. The dilution basically is circumventing proper treatment and does not reduce the overall load of toxicity. Additionally, it is inappropriate to treat metals by incineration or biodegradation. There are exceptions to this last rule, and we'll take a look at the situations later on where dilution is permissible. So the term that the LDRs use is impermissible dilution. I mean, I don't know, does Webster have impermissible? I don't. When you type it in, does it get a line under it on your word processor? And we'll take a look at the concept of permissible. The easy way to figure it out is what's permissible, and anything that's not permissible is impermissible. Right? So let's go to the next slide. The main exception to the dilution prohibition. Now we're going to be moving to these clean water systems. So the dilution prohibition is found in 268.3. It's not in your slides or your notes. I want to take a look at that. And the exception to dilution is for ignitable, corrosive, or reactive hazardous waste. Note what's not up there, not TC, but it's just ignitable, corrosive, and reactive. They may be diluted to meet LDR treatment standards. If, this is the big if, they are sent through a Clean Water Act, Clean Water Act equivalent system, or Class 1 Safe Drinking Water Act underground injection well, and if these wastes have a treatment standard of deactivation. Why do you think this is there? Think again about what we're trying to achieve with these regulations. Why would that, for this regulation, allow this exception? Can we get a mic back there, Jim? In the back, please.
I would just add one thing to your second bullet, a permitted facility that has a CWA and so on. And what we're doing is passing the buck to another regulation that is supposedly taking just as good care of the environment as we are.
And to avoid duplication of regulations on a waste stream, waste streams which enter into the Clean Water Act program and which are managed under that program, RCRA will hand it off and allow those wastes to go into that program. Assuming the assumption there, of course, is that we have adequate treatment that is going to have to occur and that the disposal into waters of the U.S. will, in fact, be protected from that facility. Yes, go ahead.
I haven't read this exclusion. Is it an exclusion?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For a while, but doesn't it actually say characteristic hazardous waste that goes through a Clean Water Act and an equivalent system?
This one, 268.3, specifically says ignitable, corrosive, and reactive.
Okay, and okay.
We have regs here.
Oh, good.
Like yeah. We can do that. No, I like having people become familiar with 268.3. Okay. I love it. Alan's a teacher. Okay, next slide, please. So one of the last prohibitions was the storage prohibition. The storage prohibition is there basically to assure that adequate treatment is provided. But at the same time, there are extensions or exemptions which are allowed, and the exemption is for storing an adequate quantity or accumulating a sufficient volume of waste in order to facilitate proper treatment, recovery, or disposal. Now, I'm a generator. What does that allow me to do? It allows me to store for a year indefinitely? No. No. If you go back to 262.34, it talks about storing waste so that it can go to a proper facility. What's that? Well, you got 90, you got the 180, and you got the 270. Right. But the key point is this. Generators, we know what their requirements are. When you move that waste from the generator, where does it go next, if it still has this? It's got to go to a TSD. So that TSD may sit there and go, I need to accumulate enough of this waste to make it so that I can, in fact, do appropriate treatment, recovery, or disposal. That TSD can store up to a year. So if you're writing a permit, of course, that's going to be covered under the 264 provision. Right? So there, that permit is one that you may want to consider that the rules allow them a longer time. So just hang on to this waste. Key point. They've got up to a year. Beyond a year, and up to that 1 year, it's up to the agency to say, that's sham storage. Beyond the year, it's up to them to be able to demonstrate that they have to accumulate for that purpose of being able to properly treat, recover, or dispose. Okay? In a nutshell, that's the prohibition against storage. We are now at a point where we're approaching our break, and we are ready to hit. We're in the question. We can take questions now from online. Tom?
Yep.
Okay. But let's go ahead and take some questions from inside the room first, and then we'll deal with the questions that have been sent in to over the Internet. First of all, Karen, what did it say? 268.3 says.
Yeah. first, I got to see it. Okay. Dilution of waste, which are hazards only because they exhibit a characteristic in a treatment system, thank you, which includes land-based units which treat waste subsequently discharged to the water of the state under Clean Water Act, da-da-da-da-da. It does not specifically say.
Whoa, wait a minute.
It says characteristic.
We have to drill down. All right, we'll drill down and we'll come to this one afterwards because I don't want to take time. But good, I love it. We're going to answer Karen's question afterwards because I think it is a drill down. Yep.
A lot of facilities that generate small quantities of lots of different waste streams. And so what we end up with is, you know, how much resource do you put into identifying things like UHCs for fairly small quantities, a lot of times, you know, single time generation waste when the LDR supply upstream at the point of generation, you know, how much training, how much resource goes into analytical and things like this versus process knowledge. Process knowledge, if you look at MSDF sheets, doesn't give you details of chemicals at small quantities at points per, you know, million levels. It gives you maybe chemicals that are a couple percent at the smallest amount. So, you know, how much analytical, how much do these people really have to know about their waste streams when it's, you know, relatively small amounts, but it'd be very resource intensive to do. And that's the problem we wrestle with.
So what I'm hearing there is I've got a facility that generates above the conditionally exempt small quantity. And so they're generating, and because they've already met the threshold, their combined waste streams may all meet, exceed that threshold, but any one particular waste stream may be very small in comparison to the total. That's the question, and the question then, as a follow-up to that is, how much leeway do you as a regulator have to allow those people not to treat their hazardous waste that's now regulated because of the aggregate? And to be able to analyze for the underlying hazardous constituents. Is this a problem that others have faced and have an answer to? You want to, can you speak up? Burden reduction, let him off the hook because he doesn't, the generic, now that's new. And then what state is that? North Carolina has that burden reduction for the small quantity generator? Or an LSUG, a large quantity, okay? I don't have an answer for you. I'm relying on the room here to see if we can get an answer. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's continue on by answering the question that came up with regard to 268.3. We're going to go to the next slide, but first let's come back and answer this question on 268.3, which was with regard to the dilution prohibition. And I think the point was that the language in 268.3 did not specifically state ignitable, corrosive, reactive waste. Instead, it says that characteristic waste may be diluted as long as their code is deactivation. That's the drill down. So we still come back to the TC waste are waste which their code is concentration-based, okay, rather than deactivation. So 268.3 has that caveat at the end about deact, which applies to D001, 2, and 3.
But also, you can treat a metal-bearing waste in a wastewater treatment facility.
That is correct. Correct. And so, that's right. It talks about the impermissible dilution.
I can't hear any of these comments.
Okay, we got a microphone coming up. The question was with regard to the impermissible dilution and specifically metal bearing waste which might go into Clean Water Act systems.
Correct, where there are Clean Water Act treatment methods that are used to treat metal-bearing waste where the metals are dropped out. And that's a very common method used. Therefore, under LDRs, they do not have a DACT specified code, but they do have a treatment level. And you can use any bona fide treatment method in which to get to that level.
That's correct. And the only one, though, that where the regs have gotten specific and looked at it and said, we're going to address impermissible dilution, was just with these DACT codes. But you're right, there are other codes or there are other provisions of the reg that allow for ways to go into Clean Water Act treatment systems or Clean Water Act equivalent or Safe Drinking Water Act.
Okay.
Yeah. We are now on the slide that comes in after break. Slide in your slide. We are still in frequently asked questions and common mistakes. What are alternative LDR treatment standards for contaminated soil? As we discussed earlier, soils are unique in that soils have a lot of heterogeneity. There's not a lot of uniformity with different types of soils and their chemistry. Some soils are going to be, they'll be contaminated, but because they've been aged, i.e. the contaminants have been on there for a very long time, the chemical permeates into the soil differently. If I have a sand versus a clay, it's all soil, but it's dramatically different in how it'll release the chemicals. So when it came to soils, it was a particularly difficult technical problem with regard to treating the soils and being able to get uniform treatment standard that would apply across the board. Hence, the soils were recognized as a separate subcategory, which required a different approach to coming up with a treatment standard because of that, the chemical characteristics and their variety with soil. The standards are found in 268.49. A particular note, at the beginning of 268.49, there is a table. There are four questions asked in that table. And if you are dealing with soils, one of the questions you're going to come up with is, do LDRs apply to me when I pick up the soil, or this soil was contaminated before LDRs, or this soil was contaminated after LDRs? Or there's a lot of variables. I would encourage you to become familiar with that table, because I think the table goes a long way toward helping you understand what is the standard that we have to meet for understanding when LDRs apply to soil. Very first table, right under 268.49. Also within 268.49, we have a standard which is a little bit different. It says we are going to treat the soil, but we're going to allow you to do well enough. If you come within, if you take your soil and you treat it, and you get 90% reduction of your underlying hazardous constituents, we're going to say that's good enough. If you come down to within 10 times the UTS value as you're treating and you haven't hit 90%, we're going to say that's good enough. However, if you are under 10 times UTS when you start, you need to go down to UTS. So it's almost a three-tiered standard where, one, you get credit for the efficiency of your reduction. Two, you get credit for higher levels and what can be achieved in reducing their contaminants. Or, if you're pretty low, the bottom becomes the UTS. Jim, I've got a question for a second. It's right here, Tom. Right here, this lady here.
Could you just explain again the low one? That was confusing.
If I, let's say the UTS is 1 for benzene. My soil comes in and it's got 5. Just because I'm under 10 times the UTS doesn't mean that I get a pass. I'm going to have to reach 1 with that soil. Okay? Good. Regardless of what we do for ignitable, reactive, and corrosive waste mixed in with soils, the treatment must remove the characteristics. So we've got this UTS, and then we also have to remove the characteristic for ignitable, corrosive, and reactive waste. And that's the soil standard. Not a lookup value. You've got this logic train that you have to follow. And, let's see if it's on this slide. Let's go to the next slide, because we'll continue with UHCs and how they affect. Blake, you've got a question?
Well, I was just going to ask
you. Felix, I was just going to ask you, can you address subparagraph D, constituent subject to treatment along the way?
Yeah, that's where we're going. So on this next slide is, what are the soil standards? Continue. The key point for soils is that hazardous waste soils must meet UTS levels. Notice I said UTS, not UHC. Hazardous waste soils must meet UTS levels for both characteristic and listed designations. Earlier we had said listed only had to meet the hazardous constituents, which were identified in 268.40. Now we're saying listed and characteristic must meet all UTS values for both characteristic and listed designations. This is different than we had previously discussed. Okay.
One thing to keep in mind, this doesn't apply to in-situ soils. Anybody? Everybody with me on that? So if I'm doing a corrective action, and these soils are sitting out there, and I haven't generated them, and I haven't placed them, this is not a standard that would apply to in-situ soils. The soil standards, of course, apply in states that are authorized for them, and, or in states where EPA administers the program. Incidental mixing of soil and hazardous waste is okay under circumstances which otherwise would be impermissible. So what we recognize there is when we're out working and moving soils around, there'll be some incidental mixing that'll occur, and so we're not going to basically be building Chinese walls around things to keep invading soils from getting mixed in. Treated characteristic soil can go to a subtitle D landfill if it meets the soil. Key point, treated characteristic soils. What do you think the answer is for listed soils? No? Blake's got a question there.
Felix, I think there's one exception to that, and that would be selenium.
Selenium?
Its treated value is, I think, 5.75. Its characteristic hazardous waste value is 1. And so it would still be a hazardous waste, but it's been treated.
Okay.
It would have to go to a subtitle C.
Soils are different. Because they can actually be soils, especially here in the West. Soils can be soils, and they're media, they're not hazardous waste, and they would still be at levels that could trigger TCLP. Yeah. So, a little, remember we started originally and said there's some room for some interpretation? The key point to understand would be, what am I starting with? What are the soils that I've got here? And what makes sense in terms of applying this particular regulation. Again, the beauty is states are the ones that are going to be implementing this, and you're more familiar than anybody with the variability of your geology and your state. Okay. Now, Blake raised an interesting question. If you go back and you look at 268, 49, there's a provision in there, and it doesn't talk about the treatment standards that have to be met. It talks instead, Blake, do you have that citation there? You need the mic on.
268.49, subparagraph D, constituents subject to treatment. When applying the soil treatment standards in paragraph C of this section, constituents subject to treatment are any constituents listed in section 268.48 table, UST, Universal Treatment Standards, that are reasonably expected to be there and present in any given volume of contaminated soil, except for fluoride, selenium sulfides, vanadium, and zinc, comma, and that are present at concentrations greater than 10 times the universal treatment standard.
So the key point about what Blake said was the constituents for soils that have to be met are the UTS, 268.48. Didn't say anything about 268.40. Okay. Different. Now, let's get back to that listed question of if I've got a soil and it's treated to meet UTS and it's listed, what can I do with that soil? There's something I can do with soil that I can't do with other waste. I can go through, well, I can do a delisting on industrial waste, but I can also do a contained out, a contained in option, can't I? Yeah. The contained in policy applies to soils and media, like water. So if I have a listed waste and I treated it down and I want to go through a contained in determination, I have that option. Rather than delisting my soil, I can also contain out the soil. And that's, again, a prerogative at the state level. It's recognized on a national level. So let's take a look at what is the containment policy. Next slide. Environmental media are not solid waste. Everybody agree with that? Water and dirt are not solid waste. You know, they haven't been abandoned and they're not waste-like. As a result, they become hazardous when they contain hazardous waste. Key point. So if I contain characteristic or listed waste, then my soil can become hazardous. If I remove the listed or characteristic, what do I have left? I have soil. I don't have solid waste. That's a recognition of media that's unique, but the process of being able to make that determination of when I have removed the characteristic or listed waste is a process that is risk-based. Right? And we'll all go through our own interpretations of what that means at the state level. There's federal guidance on that. But for the most part, it's saying, when this stuff becomes like water, you know, let's take TCE. I've got TCE. What's my drinking water standard for TCE? 5, 10 parts per billion? Along those lines? So if I've got 5 to 10 parts per billion of TCE in water, I'm at the drinking water standard, right? Is this now drinking water or is this still waste? So that's the type of thinking you have to have with the media to say, is this dirt when I get it clean enough that it starts to look like dirt, but it's still got selenium or arsenic in it? Yeah, but so do all my other soils, right? So this process of making this determination is called the contained-in determination. And it's available, the guidance is available at the federal level, and I would assume that in a lot of states, you pick that up. So, very useful for media, especially if you have large quantities of it. Okay.
Excuse me, Jim. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we noticed that when the people that are asking questions use the microphone, we can hear them perfectly, but we can't hear you very well. I don't know if you're using the same kind of microphone, but you might want to try that.
How is this? Is this better?
Is that better? A little.
Is this better?
Try it again.
Hit again.
How is this?
That's better.
Okay, we have found our technical answer. How is this?
I have a question.
Yes, sir. I'll hand you the mic.
Sure. Because contained in, or no longer contained in determinations require a risk-based determination, you get into dilution problems where, you can. And we just recently had one where a federal facility is D&Ding a building where they took a small part of it, which were sumps that had listed wastes in the sumps. They D&D the building, and they inadvertently, not sure what, combined the entire building together in one big pile of rubble, which you can obviously no longer sample because it's D&D waste anyway. And so we're having problems with, here they have a listed waste. They can't really sample. They can't really, you know, just, it's a twist on the container. I don't know if you have any issues. Maybe that's more of a comment than a caution.
I think it's a caution and a comment. You know, we find this, like, if you're doing corrective action and somebody wants to risk away the hotspot, well, then they just sample a lot of clean area. And then suddenly they say, look, there's no problem here. It doesn't matter how many acres of methyl ethyl death we have here. You know? So it is a technical issue. And I think the thing is to define what the unit is and require the units to be looked at in particular before doing an aggregate of removal of soils at an impoundment or, in your case, as the D&D. Good point. Okay, we're on that contained in is environmental media. At a minimum, the characteristic waste, the waste no longer would exhibit a characteristic to be contained out. Also, the contained out policy does not require UHCs to meet UTS levels. Word of caution, if it still has UHC levels that are too high, is this waste that can be land disposed? No. Okay.
So you can contain out, and if your UHC levels are still above land disposal restrictions, that soil still has to be brought down to meet those UHC levels. Yes, Karen?
I thought underlying hazardous constituents do not apply to soil.
In this case, the UTS levels are what you have to meet. So if you're containing out, I'm using shorthand here, UTS and UHC, right. You're still going to have to meet those LDRs. Key point, you have to meet the LDRs even if you contain out. Because otherwise you can't put it down for land disposal. Right? Now, if the waste is no longer containing hazardous waste, the key point would be, with characteristic, you have to look at those UTS. And if it's listed, we're going to have to contain it out and still also address UTS. Okay, next slide. There's another subcategory of waste called debris waste. Debris waste, as was pointed out, can come in a lot of different shapes and sizes and from facilities. And there's a definition. The only way to work with debris waste is read the definition. Up on the slide, we have a summary of it. It's basically 60 millimeter, about the size of a tennis ball, particles, which are manufactured objects, plants, or animal matter, or natural geologic material. Anything on the earth. The specific exemptions are for lead acid batteries, process residuals such as sludges, and intact containers. So if you've got materials which are like which have their own specified treatment standards, and you just can't mix it in with a bunch of debris and say it's all debris. You can't avoid that. You can't take advantage of the laxity of the debris treatment standard by mixing other things into it. The table in 268.45 has debris, has technologies, and has different chemicals. The key thing to remember with debris, once it goes through that treatment in the specified technology, you're done treating. You don't have to do concentration analyses, TCLP, you don't have to total nothing. You just take it through the technology. And at that point, you've met the treatment standard for it. What if I have listed waste? Karen? Okay.
The debris itself, you only need to meet that treatment standard for it, but any residual then would be listed.
You've raised an interesting question, and that is my treatment residuals. Residuals from the treatment, okay, is coming right here, which is on the next slide, are still regulated under 268.40. You've treated them, and so the materials that were treated can be land disposed. But the treatment residuals that came out of there, so I've got air pollution control dust, I may have other things, still carry the codes from what was in the debris. Now, you may look at debris and say, is that really debris? I see a lot of dirt. There's a 50-50 rule. If it looks like it's more than half debris, then it's debris. So if the majority of what you're looking at is debris, it's debris. Okay? And that's part of the definition of debris. The technologies that are listed in 268.45 fall into the category of extraction technologies, destruction technologies, and immobilization technologies. The types of contaminants which are present limit the use of some of these technologies. Again, you go to the table, it'll tell you what technology you can use with a particular contaminant. Characteristic debris treated by extraction or destruction that are not characteristic after treatment can be disposed in a subtitle D landfill. Right? So we still have this question of if you have to remove the characteristic for these characteristic wastes. Debris treated with immobilization technologies must still be disposed in the subtitle C landfill.
I think there was some discussion of that even in that mercury letter that we got today in the plenary sessions. Okay, next slide. Okay, let's look at corrective action, because corrective action presents an area where LDRs can pose disincentives to conducting remediation. People might say, I don't want to pick that up. If I pick that up, I've generated it, and if I generate it, man, I'm going to have to send it to the moon. I don't want to do that. Land moon disposal, that's right. The land moon disposal, that's the universal state. So as a result of that, we looked at LDRs and we said there are things that we need to do to encourage people to remediate their sites, but at the same time, things that will minimize the risk posed by that particular site. So as we look at the area of contamination policy, that's one that kind of carried over from the days of Superfund, and that basically says as long as I have contiguous contamination all around my area, I can move, segregate, do the things I need to do with waste, pick it up, put it down, and not trigger generation and placement. Okay? So an AOC policy is very useful. Again, that would be something that at the state level you would have to implement. But at the federal level, it's there that for especially Superfund and where EPA administers the RCRA program. With regard to corrective action management units, we have the same problem. We said we're generating lots of waste, but if we have to dispose of it at a commercial landfill, we're going to get tagged for transportation, as well as the treatment and the disposal. So a lot of people came back to the agency and said, if we can do this on site, this would allow us to do more corrective action. We have regulations, of course, now, and your states would have to have adopted them, that allow for an on-site construction of landfills. These landfills have some treatment standards. They have they're significantly less than LDRs. They have technical liner standards that are less than the standards for minimum tech requirements. The waste that goes into it is more uniform. And what we have allowed then is for on-site management of waste that basically doesn't meet LDRs but has had its risk lowered. Okay? So in the net scheme of things, we have lowered the risk at the site that we're remediating. Temporary units are also in that category. Temporary units would be basically units that we manage the waste in, but we don't dispose of it in. The policy on determining when contamination is caused by listed waste is one that basically says, if you don't know the source of that hazardous constituent, you don't have to make a determination that it's listed waste. What would be an example of that? TCE, ubiquitous, shows up everywhere, may not have come from a listed source, right? You don't have to assume it came from a listed source and apply listed requirements to it. You know, that's basically what that says. When I look at site-specific LDR treatment variances, we talked about that a little bit earlier, where your waste may be different than the waste that the agency looked at. And they have the ability to apply for treatment variances. If they, in fact, wanted to manage it off-site, that would be an option that they would have. Spill response exemptions, that should be a 264.1, not a 254.1 on the slide. 264.1 basically says, under emergency conditions, you are allowed to waive, forego compliance with the TSD requirements, okay, while doing emergency orders, similar to the examples we heard this morning of Florida, Mississippi. However, when the emergency is over, again, like we heard this morning, the rules still apply. So if you want to take that material off site and dispose of it, LDRs would apply at that point. The contained-in policy, we just covered a little bit earlier.
3020 exemption from groundwater reinjection is an interesting provision. I don't know how many you've got in your states, but it basically says, at a site where I'm conducting groundwater cleanup, I am allowed to take that waste water, groundwater, remove it, and put it back into the ground. That would be disposal, wouldn't it? Put it back into the ground if, in the process, I enhance the overall remediation activities at the site. You know, an example would be if I'm conducting an oil groundwater remediation, I may pull groundwater out, separate the water from the oil. I've still got quite a bit of constituents in the groundwater, and then put it back in just to sweep and bring it back and to recover more oil, right? So 3020 is one that allows you to do that as long as you're doing it at a corrective action site. Alternate LDR standards for soil and debris, we just covered them, basically are things that allow you to have treatment standards which allow for the waste to be treated and not have to meet the rigorous standards of 26840. Let's go on to the next slide. All right. The last category of alternative treatment standards is lab packs. Lab packs are usually drums or containers filled with smaller containers of chemicals. As the name implies, they're usually associated with laboratories, but they don't have to be. So I noticed in some of the slides this morning, I don't know if it was Mississippi or Florida, they had some lab pack operations where they were creating lab packs. The treatment standard for lab packs is incineration. But there are some chemicals which are prohibited from going into lab packs. Things like metal and energetic waste would be prohibited, and they're listed in 268 in Appendix 4 at the end of the rules. Let's go to the next one. Now, one of the another question that we ask is with regard to universal waste. Do universal waste have to comply with LDRs? Maybe you haven't thought to ask that question, like you've been asking that question. Okay. Universal waste must ultimately be sent to a universal waste destination facility, which would be a Subtitle C facility. The universal waste handlers, which include the generators and treaters, are exempt from testing, tracking, and record-keeping requirements found in 268.7, and Jim's going to be talking about those, and the storage prohibition found in 268.50. So they get a break. We want to encourage this material to basically be managed at these facilities. All the LDR requirements apply at the destination facility, and those requirements are found in 273.60, which is a separate section from the LDR. Okay, we're up to the last slide now. The question here is, I've treated it. I've treated my waste. What can I do with it now? Seems like an easy question. I think there's going to be lively discussion. All right, let's look first at untreated listed waste. And I think somebody's going to ask about FO3 coming up. Okay. If the waste meets treatment standards as generated, okay, meets treatment standards as generated, what can I do with that waste? Anybody? RCRA C landfill for treated. Well, it doesn't have to be treated. It already meets the concentrations for listed waste. That means its hazardous constituents are below 268.40 levels. Okay. If the waste does not meet treatment standards, where's it got to go? It's still hazardous waste, does not meet treatment standards, where's it go? Going outside, it's going to go to a Subtitle C facility to be treated because it's still listed waste. Listed waste which has been treated to meet treatment standards must be disposed of in a RCRA C landfill because it hasn't been delisted, hasn't been contained out. This still is hazardous waste. That was easy. Right? Now let's throw the twist in. Characteristics are a little bit different. Characteristic waste. Now the question is for F003 waste. For those of you that are not familiar with that, their listing code is I for ignitable. Shall we deal with that through the characteristic waste? Let's do that. Okay. Characteristic waste will always require treatment at a RIC or C unit. Do we agree? Characteristic waste will always require treatment at a C unit, except for these wastewater units.
It can be treated at the on-site.
And then I've got the comment that it could be treated on site at a generator's tank or container. True. But if it goes off site, it's going to go to a C facility. Correct?
What about a silver reclamation facility?
A silver reclamation facility.
It's not permitted.
It's not permitted. Is it a generator?
No.
It's an off-site facility that's receiving silver and it's reclaiming silver?
Yeah.
I hear some comments in the audience that there's an exclusion. Do we know where that exclusion is? 266.70 is the. We're gonna look that answer up for you. Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. So waste, characteristic waste that's going offsite has to go to where? A C unit because it's hazardous waste going offsite. To remove the characteristic, unless the waste is managed in certain clean water facilities. And there are provisions that allow for clean water facilities to manage characteristic waste. We talked about that earlier. Decharacterized waste with no UHCs or treated UHCs can go where? Solid waste. Basically, it becomes RIC or D. A RIC or D landfill, Clean Water Act equivalents, or Safe Drinking Water Act injection well. All right. Decharacterized waste with UHCs can go to a RIC or C unit for treatment before disposal, or a non-RIC. So decharacterized waste with UHCs, right, is going off-site for treatment. Can go down to a non-RICRA C unit for treatment. For treatment. Yeah, not disposal, that's for treatment. And then it can be disposed because now it's UHCs are gone, characteristics gone, now it can be land disposed. All right. Jim, do we have that citation for silver?
Yep.
Okay. Here, I'm going to give this mic to Jim Hartford.
Thank you. It 266.70. You know, Felix, you and Karen Skirmy, you have stuff memorized. I think probably you need some more activity in your lives. But in any event, it says the regulations of this subpart apply to recyclable materials that are reclaimed to recover economically significant amounts of gold, silver, platinum, palladium, iridium, osmium, rhodium, ruthenium, or any other combination of these. It goes into persons who generate, transport, or store recyclable materials that are regulated under this subpart are subject to the following requirements. And it's the notification requirements. It's essentially just reduced regulation on the part of RCRA. But there's also a separate, and I can't tell you the citation, I don't have this stuff memorized, but there's a separate provision under the regulations and in the permitting section that says if you're recycling, that doesn't require a permit, or which in essence means you don't need to be concerned with it being a RIC or C facility unless you're storing prior to reclamation.
Well, my question comes from a facility, like I said, they take characteristically hazardous silver waste and decharacterize it, but they feel that they don't need to meet LDR requirements.
Are they subject to RCRA?
Are you asking me?
Yes. Do they meet the definition of hazardous waste?
Well, let's assume not. Because I've heard the argument that, LDR requirements apply unless specifically provided otherwise. And so if it doesn't specifically state that they don't apply, then you're to assume that they do. And therefore, I would feel that, if it doesn't meet treatment standards, then they would have to meet LVR requirements.
Let's back it up. I have to have a solid waste. Solid waste has to be a hazardous waste. Once it's a hazardous waste, it becomes prohibited under current regulations. So that's why I asked, is it a hazardous waste?
Well, it's not after that treatment, but it was at the point of generation. I mean, isn't that what we said, that LVR becomes applicable at the point of generation?
And so can we do this offline?
Sure.
Okay. you have... Why don't you send that? Are you at a computer?
I'm not at the second, but I can get to one.
And what's the address to send in the comments?
There's a button on the Fluent website. Just press it, and then it'll send you to the right location.
Okay.
But in the meantime, we have a bunch of questions here on our site. Tom, could you read them off one by one, please, and we'll do our best to answer them.
Actually, most of them talking about the sound. But I have one here, and I'm just going to read it how it's written. It says, if there is remediation waste generated from a site that had a spill prior to 1970, this site has a pesticide waste that shows it is not a hazardous waste. And that's what it said. When do LDR rules start? When the spill occurred prior to 1970, or when the soil is excavated for disposal?
Would the person that asked that question go to 268-45, or soil treatment, is it 45? Yes. Which one is soil? Thank you. No, 49. 268-49, and that's that table that I was referring to. When do LDRs apply to the soil that I have generated? And if that doesn't answer your question, would you come back with a second question?
Okay, and actually we only have one other one so far. It says, why do all hazardous waste transporters still include LDRs with every shipment?
Tom, could you repeat that one more time, please? Just for my benefit.
Yeah. Why do all hazardous waste transporters still include LDR with every shipment?
Well, the hazardous waste transporter is just acting as an agent for the generator. It's actually the generator responsible for providing the LDR information to the TSDF. As a result, and that's a requirement under the 268 LDR requirements. Only if they, I'm going to get to that in a second when I get into the notification requirements here. Yeah. And a good point. I was just told you by Karen. It's essentially just a business decision on the part of the transporter. But if the transporter chose not to do that, then the generator would have to provide that same information on his own, using his own forms and his own information.
Okay. Jim, I have one more.
Hey, go ahead.
All right. Okay. Okay, here it goes. Our household hazardous waste collected, accumulated in bulk for disposal at a TSD. From community household hazardous waste collection events, subject to LDR requirements.
And the answer would be no, because it's not a hazardous waste under the RCRA regulations. It's been a long-standing policy on the part of EPA that household hazardous waste retains its exemption clear through all treatment and disposal. So technically, that stuff could go directly to a landfill if somebody chose to do that, a RCRA DE landfill. So the key point there is that once it's household hazardous waste, it retains its exemption, and LDR doesn't apply. It can't apply because it's not a hazardous waste to start with.
Did the button on the bottom?
one thing. You have to hold it.
In Missouri, for example, we have more stringent regulations where if you have that kind of segregated waste at a TSD, it becomes subject to all regulation.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, Tom. It's a very important point because every state is can operate separately, and we often do. That's part of the challenge of putting one of these together. I believe Felix, when we first started out, pointed out that what we're talking about today are the federal regulations, and so each one of the states have to go back and check their own regulations, because the way they've written them. But certainly states can be more restrictive, and many are. Some of our states, like Nebraska, for example, have pretty much followed the federal regulations down the line, which simplifies things to some degree. At least it does for the EPA inspectors. But that's a good point. Thanks for bringing that up. What I'm going to do now is just kind of go through very fast some of these notification requirements. Felix had the hard job of bringing up all the hard stuff in LDR. From here on in, it's pretty straightforward. Either you have to do it or you don't. Could I get somebody to hit the slides over here? Just hit page down. And let's go to the slide 39, please. Page down. Thank you. Okay, we're just going to be talking about the notification requirements and paperwork requirements that are under 268.7. First off, there are several cases where they're one-time notices, and that was brought up in a question just a little while ago. If you generate a hazardous waste, you have to send a one-time notification, land disposal restriction notice, a notification form to that treatment facility on the first shipment of that waste to that facility. If you, at some future point in time, if you change the waste or you change the facility, you have to re-notify. There's also there are some wastes that if there's excluded or exempted after the point of generation, you have to have a one-time notice saying where you sent it, and you must be kept on the on-site files. You don't have to send it to anybody else. And I was asked pointedly last night by a well-known speaker on LDR, what might be an excluded or exempted after point of generation example? Well, one comes to mind right away is the waste that goes into a clean water act system or UIC, or perhaps a waste that's been granted a variance under the under corrective action. I do want to point out that the notification requirements I'm talking about here have looked at the April 4, 2006 Burden Reduction Initiative changes, and these are included in the slides. I've also been asked to point out that these slides are also going to be available at the Atswama website in the future. Obviously not right today, it's a little too soon. Let's go to slide 40, please. Next slide. Okay, we talked about the initial shipment of waste not meeting the treatment standard. If it's going to a TSDF, that notification has to go to the TSDF and also one kept in the generator file. And again, re-notify when the waste or facility changes. If the waste meets the treatment standard at the point of generation, which can happen, an example of that would be, let's say, a rag that was used to wipe off an ignitable solvent. If the rag itself, at the point of generation, when it's ready to be thrown away, no longer has any free liquid, it obviously is no longer a hazardous waste. So it's not a hazardous waste at the point of generation. But if you get that kind of a waste, first off, if it's not hazardous, the LDRs don't apply. But if it meets the treatment standard at the point of generation, it is hazardous, and it also happens to meet the 268.48 tables or 0.40 tables. Then you have to send a notification to the TSDF and also keep one in the generator's file.
And that's, and again, re-notify when the waste or facility changes. If this is due to treatment, then you have to have an available waste analysis data that demonstrates that it does meet the standard. Further one-time notices, next slide, please, 41, are characteristic waste treated to be to non-hazardous. That requires both a notification and certification. The certification is merely a statement that you're going to find in several areas in Part 268 that says, yea, verily, I guarantee that this stuff is what I say it is. That's the essence of the certification. But they're very specific, and you have to use the exact words. The way you can find out whether you need to do a certification or not is that there is a table at 268.7. There's a table there that you can go through. It's kind of a matrix, and it'll tell you if there's a certification required for that particular type of waste. And yes, it's a little tedious to use, but that's what the generator has to do. But that notification and certification must go into the generators or treaters files, and it used to have to be sent to the state or the EPA. The burden reduction rule removed that requirement, which is a good thing. Because if we got it, we wouldn't know what the heck to do with it anyway. Except put it in the facility's files. That's about it. You must update the notification when the waste changes, of course, either by process or the operation or the waste itself, just in general. If you're sending waste to a Subtitle D receiving facility, if that changes, you have to notify yourself, essentially, with what's happening and keep it on files. Next slide, please. So I promise I go through this fast because I'm sensing a certain amount of combat fatigue in the room. There's only so much LDR you can take in one sitting, and we have exceeded that at least 20 minutes ago. And that's not Felix's fault. That's just the nature of the subject, I'm afraid. Notification requirements. Characteristic waste treated to non-hazardous, continued. The notification requires the name and address of the RCRA D facility receiving the waste. Now, you don't have to notify the RCRA D facility, per se, but you do have to make a notation in your own files. There's got to be a description of the waste as initially generated in this notification. And it must include the original waste code, treatability group, for example, wastewater, non-wastewater, UHCs, underlying hazardous constituents, unless all the UHCs are treated and monitored. And it can't go to a RCRA D facility unless the UHCs are treated, even though you treated the waste to be non-hazardous. And that's something that's often forgotten when you see somebody doing their own waste treatment in their own tanks or containers, which is perfectly acceptable. You just got to meet the LDR if you're going to send it off to a land facility or store it indefinitely. Certification, again, when there is a certification required, the statements, as they're written in 268, section 268 of the 40 CFR, will tell you if it needs to be signed by an authorized representative or to have a separate certification language, and almost all of them do. Let's go to the next slide, please.
Yeah. On the green bullet, it says can't go to an RCRA D facility unless the underlying hazardous constituents are treated. Now, is that, has it been decharacterized?
Yeah.
Okay. Couldn't it still go to a Subtitle D because it's no longer hazardous, but it's just been improperly treated?
You can tell me if I'm wrong here, but the operative principle here is that LDR is attached at the point of generation, which goes back to one of the original questions. Yeah, once it attaches, you're stuck with it, even though the waste becomes non-hazardous. So the UHCs would have to be treated before you could to the appropriate levels under the UTS table until such time as they are, you can't send it to a Record D facility because it doesn't meet the treatment standards. Yeah, Record D disposal. That's correct. Now, what else they'd be doing with it, I don't know, frankly. Okay. Back to 40, slide 43, thank you. Okay, this is an area that I frankly am not all that comfortable with among many, which is the hazardous degree considerations. The notification does have to include contaminants subject to treatment, and that the indication that the constituent is being treated were done via the alternative treatment standards. It's interesting that the wording in 268 says an indication. I don't know why anybody would want to have an inference on something like that. Why don't you just say, hey, we did it this way, but that's the way it's worded. Contaminated soil considerations. Contaminated soils are probably the one area that we get the most questions on day to day, even from our own remediation section or just from outside consultants dealing with this stuff. The receiving facility getting the contaminated soil must have a one-time notice, must get a one-time notice, and a copy must be kept in the facility's file. I think I believe the underlying principle there is that we want to be, the EPA, as do the states, have an underlying interest in ensuring that potential hazardous waste is being properly treated and going to the right kind of facilities. In this way, we can track if an inspector ever comes by who received the waste. And again, table 268.7, table 8 has those has the statements or directory to the proper paragraph with the statements that you need for any kind of certifications. Next slide, please. 44. This has not changed. Any determination records you've done for LDR must be kept for a minimum of 3 years. Most people are advised to hang on to them forever because of potential legal ramifications. A waste analysis plan is required if managing prohibited waste to meet treatment standards. And that's something that's often forgotten. And quite frankly, most of us don't like to look at waste analysis plans because it's an extra step in an inspection. But if they're treating hazardous waste to meet the standard, they have to have a waste analysis plan, and it must include certain things. And those certain things are spelled out in 268 again. One of the famous ones is the famous tolling agreement exemption for LDR notification. Or for the hazardous waste manifest, actually. And the tolling agreement is what I like to call the safety clean paragraph, which is really essentially what it is. An outfit that goes in and picks up waste, recycles it, and brings it back in their own trucks and in their own equipment is operating what's called a tolling agreement. You will not find those words in Part 268 or anywhere in the regulations. It's just one of those common terminologies that we tend to use when we speak in tongues in the waste world. But what that means, though, is that you don't need these. If you have a small quantity generator generating under waste under a tolling agreement, that does not require a hazardous waste manifest. But an LDR is, in fact, still required. LDR notification is still required. And again, those records must be kept for 3 years after the agreement termination. So it's not necessarily after the waste has been generated, but after you quit using that particular tolling agreement arrangement. Next slide, please. Okay, if the waste meets the treatment standards as generated, it once again has to be a one-time notification and certification with the initial shipment, as we talked about previously. If the waste does not meet treatment standards as generated, or the generator chooses not to determine if it meets standards, there's a one-time notification again required to the facility in the generator's file with information required at paragraph 268.7, Bolex A, Bolex 2. And that's just one of those things that they're required. Next slide, please. Land tax.
Do you have any other questions?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not making a determination, you need to include the UHCs or in your notification.
Well, what you have to do is you have to tell the facility that you have not made that determination. I think this was from a previous question dealing with the burden reduction initiative, and that's a good point to make. But if you're sent into some place and you haven't identified UHCs, you're required to tell the facility that you didn't do so, and it cannot meet the LDR standards for land disposal until, of course, UHCs are treated. Frankly, I don't see any particular anything to be gained by giving that responsibility over to a TSDF to do the waste determination, particularly UHCs, when the standard to me is not all that tough. As Felix pointed out earlier in the session, if you've got a waste, you know, you pretty much know what's going in it, and the only thing you really have to understand is that you don't need to identify things that are not reasonably expected to be present in that waste. And that gives a wide latitude. I always advise generators to take that wide latitude because it's easier for them and it's, quite frankly, easier for us. I'm not all against that kind of thing. Go ahead. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Next one here is lab packs. That also requires a one-time notice and certification, but you do not need to identify UH underlying hazardous constituents when you're dealing with lab pack waste. As long as you meet the, as long as it's not holding anything that's in 40 CFR 268 Appendix 4, such things as mercury. Mercury contaminated waste, and that doesn't necessarily mean liquid mercury. What that means is like mercuric oxide, any kind of waste, like any mercuric compound, or P10 waste. Those are things that you cannot put into a lab pack. And that has very much to do with the way lab packs are treated, which is by incineration. So the UHCs for characteristic waste do not need to be identified in any of the notices or certifications. Next slide, please. For characteristic waste that are no longer hazardous, again, a one-time notification or certification to the generator or treaters on-site files, and what used to be the EPA or state, again, the requirement to go to the EPA or state is removed. You still have to have it in the treater's on-site files. Again, which is something that most inspectors are very reluctant to get into because that could go on forever, checking those kinds of files. But it is something that the generator has to do if he generates a characteristic waste that is no longer hazardous for whatever reason. He's got to include the record deed facility that's being sent to, the waste and the waste description itself with treatability groups, UHCs, etc. Updated if the changes occur. And previously, there used to be a requirement to tell the state annually by December 31st if there were changes. That's no longer required. I'm not entirely sure anybody ever did that or any of us ever really checked. I know I certainly haven't. But there it is. Now we don't have to anymore. But again... those are federal regulations that change. So unless your state makes the changes in their own regulations, you're kind of stuck with whatever you've written previously. Okay, waste analysis plan. Next slide. The generator that does his own treatment in the tanks or containers has to meet LDR requirements. And this particular section that I'm talking about here has to do with generator waste, not permitted TSDF waste. They require a waste analysis plan regardless. I'm not talking about their waste analysis plan. That's almost always required by permit regardless. If you manage it to meet the LDR treatment standard, you've got to have a waste analysis plan. This does not apply to the alternative debris standards, because, quite frankly, all you need to do there is demonstrate that you met the standard. which is in some cases just like abrasion or whatever it might be in that regard. And if there's a chemical or physical analysis being required in order to demonstrate that you've done that, you have to show what you did in that regard in the waste analysis plan. Okay, and that includes all info needed to treat the waste, how often you do this testing. It's got to be written, and you have to have a notification in your files. Okay, it is now 3:45. We're running a little late. We've had a lot of questions along the way. We pretty much covered very, very fast land disposal restrictions. We can actually sit there for a week and have a course on this stuff and just begin to touch the surface, but this is a pretty experienced crowd in here and online too. But if there are any further questions, please ask them now.
Yeah, I got one or two on the web still.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Here it goes, from beautiful downtown Olympia, Washington. Can hazardous fluorescent lamps be treated under the alternative treatment standards for hazardous debris, both for crushed lamp debris and whole lamps? Thanks, Rob.
Okay, and I'm getting a shaking head over here. Okay, let's check.
That was the nature of the GAO report that we got this morning. So whole lamps would not meet that category. Obviously, if they've been crushed and small, they would fall into that category. But there'd be that question of permissible dilution. You know, if you're going to take your lamps and then crush them up so that they can become debris, you know, that certainly wouldn't be appropriate.
Okay.
Right.
One last one from Austin, Texas. Do it.
Okay.
Okay. My question relates to dilution prohibition. Whether solidification and stabilization of organic waste, like for creosote contaminated waste, is considered dilution.
Which F code is it? Is it an F code or?
Oh, Faye, you didn't give me the F code.
Didn't give me the F code. Is it for, did it say characteristic or listed waste?
Not enough info.
If whoever put that one in there, if they'd come back and give us a waste code, we'd be able to address that more appropriately.
Thanks.
And any questions in the room?
If a waste is inappropriately treated, has a generator, do any violations belong to the generator? If you have a filter from some process, it's a metal filter, and it's contaminated with metal dust, and it goes for incineration, you know, because usually generators just contact somebody. You know, they deal with a treatment facility, and probably 90% of them think, you know, hey, I gave it to the experts, and they're treating my waste. But we've seen going through this facility list of the waste that they treat, that there's, you know, incinerators are taking waste that have F code, metal code. And now and then we find where, maybe this wasn't quite right. There's a generator at fault.
I think we have some input from this from Utah.
I think this is a hard one to do because it's hard to go back on a generator that's not in good faith. But I think if you started by looking at the manifest and the declaration that the generator makes on the manifest, he says he's found the right treatment facility or storage facility or disposal facility to handle his waste. So you could show culpability for not having performed due diligence.
Jim?
Yeah, it's a shame we can't do this on... We don't have a webcam here. This is strictly audio. But Jess and I discussed a question like this earlier, and the standard response, which will almost always be correct and rigorous, you stand there, and you have a furrowed look on your face, furrowed brow. You rub your chin knowingly, and you say, "It depends."
and people will think you're wise beyond your age. But that's a good question, and I have to agree with your comments. That would be the way that we would look at that due diligence, because there is a statement made. If you hit the next slide, please. In fact, go up to slide 52. Felix will hate me for this, but I did put his phone number on this slide. But in the interest of equity, I put my own on there also. And if anybody's got questions, they can either call us or just send us an email. They're both correct. We didn't put any wrong information there. I think they're onto us though. But in any event, next slide, please. Felix brought up this website right here next to the gold medal. That is, I have a chance to look at that, and it is an absolutely excellent site for finding out information about LDR-related questions. I recommend it to anybody that has to deal with LDR on a routine basis. And we did check all these websites, and they were working when we checked them. So they're there if you want them. And I think that's all we have time for now, because we're actually over time. And